This week on Grape Encounters Radio.
You made the champagne for the Seoul Olympics?
Yes, it was in 1988.
Wow.
It was the first sparkling wine ever made in South Korea, and I was very, very fortunate to be the one that helped the project. It was a lot of fun. We didn't make a very good wine because, well...
And now, transmitting our signal to wine lovers of the world from our Atascadero Wine Cellar Studio in the heart of the Central Coast wine country of San Luis Obispo County, California, we bring you Grape Encounters with David Wilson.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow, talk to me nice.
And it is time for your weekly Grape Encounter, and I have to tell you that last week I got quite a chuckle as I read a story that was ripping through the internet about a product that was attributed to the famous champagne makers Veuve Clicquot. They showed a box that was, you know, kind of a square, small square box that had the famous champagne makers logo on it. And just a cardboard box, but inside the cardboard box were individually wrapped tablets. And the claim was that you could take that tablet and you could drop it into an ordinary glass of water and you would have instant champagne. How wonderful that would be. Well, you know what? We all know the biblical stories of turning water into wine, so why not water into champagne while we're at it? Unfortunately, it's been a long time since anybody turned water into wine, and as far as I know, nobody's ever turned water into champagne. It turned out to be a hoax. It was actually the doing of a devious Russian ad agency that I guess was trying to start a new Cold War inside an ice bucket. Well, we're going to talk about champagne, sparkling wines, and all things bubbles today. And there's probably no better person for us to talk about that subject with than the gentleman who's sitting with me today. It's Christian Roganon, and he is the winemaker for the Niven Family Wine Estates, which is a Christian. Now, how many brands? It's like six or seven, right?
We have Tangent, Belliana, Trenza, Zarker, and a new brand, True Myth, all here in San Luis Obispo.
Okay, we're in San Luis Obispo County, but, you know, of course, for those who are not in this area, you know, this discussion today is more about how the bubbles get in there, what's good, what's not, what you should look for, and to really give you just a quick education about what your options are, and probably more than anything, why it is that bubbles have become one of the fastest growing segments of the wine market right now. It's bubbles and pink are in right now in a very big way. And champagne is not just for celebrations anymore. And the interesting thing about Christian, there are many interesting things, but maybe one of the most is that you started off in France making champagne, right?
Yes, I did. Indeed, in the early 80s, actually, I worked with two different companies in Champagne, so I had the chance to really get a good understanding not only on the making but the culture of Champagne. And, you know, this industry has been there for 350 years, so it's just fascinating. And I really learned. I had this extraordinary opportunity to work with a winemaker that had been working there for 52 years in the cellar, and I went literally under his arm, and every day he spent an hour with me showing me different things. So, after a couple of years, I was able to really capture and accumulate an extraordinary array of knowledge, and that really helped me in my career tremendously.
So you're not faking that accent, right?
No, and even though I've been here for many, many years, I still have it a little bit.
You know, it comes in handy, doesn't it?
Well, yes, that's
especially
true.
If you're trying to get a date. What brought you to the States?
Well, in 1986, there was a winery in Arroyo Grande, which is today still here today, named Maison Dutz, and it was actually owned by Champagne Dutz. And I came for a couple of months to help with harvest and set things up, and I really, really fell in love with the area. I found Americans being very friendly, warm, and I just decided, you know, instead of going back to France, I think that's going to be my new place to live.
All right, the burning question. Are Americans less pretentious about wine than the French?
Oh, yes. I agree with that.
Okay, second question. Why is it that we're reading all these stories about how the wine culture in France is really, really losing ground, and that young people growing up in France are less and less familiar with wines? And there was an interesting survey that recently said that a good number, and it was, I don't remember the exact statistic, but it was a big number, percentage of French can't tell the difference or don't know the difference between champagne and regular still wine anymore. Do you believe that?
Well, I'm not really surprised. I think, champagne and wine in general, it's almost like the fashion industry. I give you an example. 15, 20 years ago, everybody was drinking Merlot. If you were cool, you would order a glass of Merlot. Then right. It became Pinot Noir. And Merlot now is not as popular as it used to be. And I think in France, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, wine was really popular, but now people drink more beers, drink hard liquor, cocktails. I think it's just a fad for the moment, and it'll go back again. It's just it's really interesting. It's like the fashion industry. Things go up and down.
Who would have thought that the French would be slipping in their wine drinking and the Chinese would be going crazy for it at this point?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But look at it, how just the wine itself, how it changes. When you look at Pinot Noir in France in the last 100 years, at the beginning of the 1900s, the wines were really big, concentrated, and rich.
Yes.
By the 60s, 70s, they become a lot lighter, less alcohol, less color. And now the wines are getting big, fuller, richer. Another example, between the 20s and the 60s, 90% of the champagne was sweet. Now, the demi-sec or sec champagne represent probably 3 or 4%. Now it's all brut. So the wine changes with time. It's really like...
That seems like a big mistake on the part of the champagne makers, because I think that it's universally known and understood that the millennials, the younger generation, are migrating towards sweeter wines, not dry wines. So you would think that they would at least tailor some of those wines, you know, to suit the tastes of this, you know, next generation of wine drinkers.
I agree with you. I'm sure, you know, the largest company, LVMH, Louis Vuitton, Wet Hennessy, which actually produced one bottle out of three is produced by them. I'm sure they have a marketing.
Is that right?
Yeah. There's 300 million bottles of champagne produced and sold everywhere in the world, and they sell about 100 million. But I'm sure they study very well what the consumer wants, and there's no question they do it right. I mean, it's quite successful. Oh. In 20 years, the quantity of champagne has moved from about 220 million to 300 million bottles. So obviously, there's a lot of growth.
Almost a 30%. Yes. Increase in consumption right now.
Correct. Yeah.
And going up every year too, as far as I can see.
Yeah, there is the increasing planting area every year slowly because there's demand, particularly with China. Now it's China. It's just is an enormous market for champagne.
Well, for the moment, but they're just going to make their own pretty soon.
Absolutely.
They copy everybody. Well, those clever Chinese.
Oh, there's no question. And in China, we will see... Not right away, but in probably 20, 30 years, very, very good wines because they hired consultants from Australia, from France. They're looking at every site possible. And yeah, there's no question.
I would think the French would say, no, I'm sorry, we're not going to do that and not share that knowledge. I'm just kidding, Christian. I guess if I was made a big offer by the Chinese, I would be over there.
Yeah, and
telling them how to make champagne.
Oh, and now there is even French cooperage that have installed facilities where they make barrels. And same thing with the equipment. There's actually factories now that actually produce wine equipment in China for the Chinese market. It's no question. It's going to be it is now the number one market in the world in volume, and it'll continue to grow.
Yeah. We're talking to Christian Roganaw. He is the vice president of winemaking, the head winemaker at the Niven Family Wine Estates in the Edna Valley of California, that's on the Central Coast, but has broad experience all over the world making champagne. You made the champagne for the Seoul Olympics?
Yes, it was in 1988.
Wow.
It was the first sparkling wine ever made in South Korea, and I was very, very fortunate to be the one that helped the project. It was a lot of fun. We didn't make a very good wine because, simply because something that I never suspected, we had monsoon during harvest.
Oh, no.
So it was very difficult. It rained almost every other day. The wine had beautiful bubbles as a nice, you know, color. and it was called actually Grand Joie, which means the greatest joy, happiness. It was a lot of fun. It's something that I'll never forget. And I was, you know, just thrilled.
It wasn't terrible, though, right?
No, it was just, I wouldn't say it would be never like a bottle of French champagne. It was just, it was a nice, refreshing, sparkling wine.
Now, did you call it sparkling wine or did you call it champagne?
No, we call it sparkling
wine. You called it sparkling.
The Method Champenoise.
So hold that thought because we're going to get a little deeper into Method Champenoise. And we'll talk about stunning growth of sparkling wines in America now. When we return with Grape Encounters Radio, so pleased to have my guest Christian Rogan on. All right, we'll be back with more Grape Encounters. So just do me a favor, turn up your radio so you can hear the commercials and go fill up your glass, and we'll be right back.
While you're letting the wine breathe, Facebook us at facebook.com/Grape Encounters Radio. And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues.
Take the blood out of an alligator. Grab a bowl of green swamp funky water. Then count from 1 to 9. Spit over your left shoulder. And you got alligator wine. Alligator wine. You old porgy pie.
Back with Grape Encounters Radio, and we're talking about all things fizzy here today, and we'll do that for most of the show. My guest right at the moment is Christian Roganaugh. He is the winemaker at the Niven Family Wine Estates, which encompasses several great brands like Baileyana, Tangent, Trenza, Cadre, Zocker.
And True Myth.
And True Myth. Yes. I love that name. That's a good name for a rock band.
Yes.
And it's an oxymoron, right? True myth.
Yes, well, it's really the myth of Mother Nature. It's really what we have and when we call it this way, because Mother Nature, really, it's kind of a myth. We never know what she's going to give us. Some years she's very generous and give us a lot of grapes, and some years it's more challenging.
So what is the difference, for those who don't know, between sparkling wine and champagne? And how many different sparkling beverages are actually out there?
Well, to call a sparkling wine champagne, it has to be produced in Champagne and exclusively with grapes that come from vineyards that are in the district of Champagne. So if the grapes are outside of the Champagne area, you cannot call it champagne. Now, there is a very particular sets of rules on how to make champagne in terms of yield into the vineyards, the varietals you're allowed to use, which are Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, which is a clone, a cousin of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and you have a particular yield you have to follow into the vineyards, and the method is very precisely described, and the secondary fermentation that actually create the effervescence, the carbonation, must be done inside the bottle. So that method is called the méthode champenoise, the traditional method, and that method is actually used in many, many other countries around the world, like in California, for instance, or in Spain with a cava wine, and you can produce a sparkling wine from the méthode champenoise. So it's the second fermentation inside the bottle.
And that term méthode champenoise is very important because
yes,
for most people who see that on the bottle, it's the same as seeing the word champagne, is it not?
Well, there is three different ways to make sparkling wine. One is inject with a little pump some CO2, carbon dioxide, inside
say
the bottle.
No, like making soft drinks.
Yeah, and that's basically like how Coca-Cola is made, and it makes the wine that is frankly not very good and give you a headache generally. The second method is actually the one is carbonated into a very sturdy tank. You basically, after the wine has been, the base wine has been made and filtered, you add yeast and sugar inside the stainless vessel. And within a few weeks, the wine will now be carbonated. Basically, the yeast consume the sugar, and the sugar of the yeast release the carbon dioxide, pressurizing the tank, and then the wine is then transferred into bottles and corked.
Under pressure.
Under pressure, absolutely.
Very important.
Very, and obviously not to lose the carbonation, but remember the CO2 is actually dissolved into the wine itself. So if you keep everything under pressure, the carbon dioxide and the CO2 will stay into the wine. And the last method, we just talked about it, is the champagne method.
So you've made champagne in Champagne.
Yes.
Born in Dijon. Oui. Home of the mustard, right?
Yes. Very true, indeed.
How many mustard jokes did you have to deal with growing up?
I don't know. I can't remember.
But a few, right?
Yeah. Yes, of course.
But you came out here some years ago to the U.S., and now in the last couple of years, and I'm going to say about the last 5 years, there's been this extraordinary growth of consumption of sparkling wines. I think probably not just in the U.S., but all over the world. What happened?
Well, I think, as we said, when in great moment, you want, and when everything goes good, you want champagne to celebrate or sparkling wine. And when things go bad, when the economy is challenging, you want to feel better. So you open a glass of champagne. So you need champagne in both cases, when things go well and when things go wrong.
You need it to drown your sorrows and to celebrate your victories. For one thing, there are such a large number of people now that want to become sommeliers. You know, we're seeing that, and especially like if you go to Asia, they have, you know, the Asian Institute that trains sommeliers there. You know, they have thousands and thousands of people that are undergoing that training. And I think that as people begin to get more knowledge of sparkling wines and champagne, they learn that it isn't just about New Year's Eve. It isn't just about celebrating your birthday. It isn't about your wedding anniversary. That you can actually drink champagne and sparkling wines all the way through dinner, right?
Oh, absolutely. Sparkling wine, champagne goes very, very well with food. But just to add to what you were saying is, you know, young women now 21 to 40 drink more and more wine. It's very interesting. And they drink a lot of white wine and they drink sparkling wine. So I think the husband or boyfriend buy more and more sparkling wine to please the ladies. So
well,
I think,
yeah, of course. Well, that's been going on since the beginning of time, right?
Yes, but I think more now because the younger generation, they really enjoy wine. They go on the internet, they do their research, they try different wine, different brands, different sparkling wine. I think more and more it becomes cool or fashionable to drink wine because it shows that you have culture. I think it's also linked to the world of food and wine. You know, television has so many cooking shows now, so there's a huge interest for wine in general.
Our guest today is Christian Roganon. He is the Vice President of Winemaking at the Niven Family Wine Estates, and we will continue our discussion of all things bubbly on Grape Encounters Radio, so stay with us.
Grape Encounters continues. Visit our website at grapeencounters.com.
I wonder why my baby drinks so much wine. If she keeps drinking, she's gonna lose her mind. She's a winehead woman, don't you know? She's a winehead woman, don't you know?
We're back with more Grape Encounters Radio, and we're talking to Christian Roganon, who is the Vice President of Winemaking for the Niven Family Wine Estates on the central coast of California in the Etna Valley. Beautiful place and beautiful facility I'm sitting in. I think they've got like 6 different labels or 7. Is that right, Christian?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, you make a lot of wine. Yeah, do you ever get to go home?
I do.
I invited you to a party to come speak, and you said, I'm going to be out harvesting until 10 o'clock.
Oh yeah, during harvest, it's the grapes do not wait. We have to.
Why can't they wait just one more day? Check the radar. Anyway, we've been talking about sparkling wines. Do you think that over recent years we have weeded out a lot of the really terrible champagne and sparkling wine? Because I mean, honestly, there was a glut of sparkling beverages that you and I would not drink.
It's absolutely true.
We would wake up, and instead of putting a Veuve Clicquot a tablet and a glass of water, we would put an Alka-Seltzer in instead because it would give you a terrible headache because it was really not the real thing to begin with.
I could not agree more. This is a very good statement. And here's the reason why, really, is we have had, you know, many very good school now to learn viticulture and enology. So most wineries now have a winemaker and enologist, someone that really understands the science of fermentation and winemaking. There is tremendous improvement into growing grapes. The way we grow grapes now is so different now, and the technology used is amazing. I mean, we can even use satellite pictures of vineyards now to look at it in different colors. And I mean, it's all the computerized things helps us out to grow better grapes. And the wine equipment is so different. In 20 years, we get better pumps, better presses. So we have truly extraordinary tools we can use in the vineyards and not the winery to make better wine. And there is, if you don't make good wines now, you're out of business.
If you don't make good wines now, there's something wrong with you because you have all the tools to do it and you should be doing something else.
So true.
You should be selling cars.
Probably.
So are you telling me that you pour over satellite pictures of your vineyards?
Well, we can actually.
Do you do that?
Well, yes, we do. So you can actually, from up above, you have a picture of your vineyard so you can see the weaker area. And you'll be able to determine, for instance, well, I need to put more water into here. So you can modify your drip line system to be able to water one particular section of the vineyards. And you can actually literally walk into vineyards with a GPS and track and actually mark down exactly different up to the plant. So you have the extraordinary technology that allows you to map your vineyards and really be able to apply whatever needs to be done to the vineyards in one section, and you can remember it.
Anyway, let's talk about that method Champenois, because for the most part in the places in the U.S., and it's not just California, it's Washington, it's Oregon, it's New York, you know, many different places are making, you know, great sparkling wines. And most of them, I think, in this country are doing it that way, are they not?
Yeah, the method Champenoise, which is the method, the secondary fermentation takes place inside the bottle itself. So you have a very slow carbonation of the wine, so to speak. It takes about 6 weeks for the sugar and the yeast to react one another and create that 90 pounds of pressure, which you have in a bottle of a sparkling wine from Method Champenoise.
So tell us where the method of making wine and the method of making champagne, where they part company in the road.
First, to make a sparkling wine, you need to make a base wine. So you make a white wine, like a
just
traditional
like any
white
other wine.
Except it has to be at lower alcohol, and the grapes are harvested a lot earlier than for still wine. And the reason for that, during the carbonation, during the secondary fermentation after the wine, the base wine has been made, and now you want to carbonate the wine, you will have an increase of alcohol of about 1.5%. And it is essential for sparkling wine to be around 12.5% alcohol, because if you're up above 13, you don't see those exciting and tiny little bubbles coming out of the wine. The carbonation is there, but it doesn't have the fuzziness.
I hear what you're saying, but nobody knows why that's true. Why is that true?
Because when the CO2 is in a high concentration of alcohol, it's dissolved into the wine, but it has a harder time to escape the bonding of the CO2, and the wine is such that in high alcohol concentration, you don't see the bubbles. They have a hard time to separate from the wine itself.
So just like human beings, the alcohol holds you back.
Yeah. And I give you an example. If anybody wants to taste, check that at home. Next time you bottle a sparkling wine, pour just a little spoon of cognac into it. And you're going to see it kills immediately all the effervescence of the wine. It's still there, but it disappeared. And this is why in France, in Champagne, if the wine is over 13% of alcohol, you cannot call it Champagne. You lose the appellation.
So he just gave you all a little hint that if you don't like the bubbles and, you know, your wife or your, you know, counterpart wants Champagne and you don't, just take a little shot of vodka. Put it in the glass, it'll kill the bubbles instantly, and you'll both be happy. And you'll actually be a little happier. And you can do that, right? It's your wine, right?
Absolutely.
You will not be arrested by the sparkling wine or champagne police.
That's...
Maybe in France you will, but not here. Okay, so that's the difference. And then let's talk about what goes on in the process from there on out. Because once it gets bottled, you know, how long does it take before it's actually champagne? And talk about removing the sediment and a few things like that.
Of course, yeah. It's actually a very complex method, and it... After the wine is actually bottled, you have to touch the bottle approximately 40 times to have the wine completely finished.
So you have to touch it 40 times?
40 times.
Do you count?
Not really, but...
You have a little stick that you put notches in. Okay.
So here's the way, actually, the champagne sparkling wine is made. We have a base wine, which is perfectly filtered and clean, blended. And then we add... yeast and sugar to the tank, mix sugar, yeast, and the wine very well, and right away bottle the wine. And in fact, when we bottle the wine, we don't add a cork, but we add a crown cap. And in the next 6 to 8 weeks, very slowly, the sugar is going to be consumed by the yeast, about, I would say, 0.5 gram a day. It's very small. And then the carbonation starts to take place into the bottle. And after 6 to 8 weeks, you have a fully carbonated wine with 6 atmospheres of pressure, 6 bars of pressure. And it's a very high pressure. That would be the pressure you would have 66 yards below sea level. So it's really intense. And the glass has to be particularly strong to hold that pressure. And then
is that why there's the indentation in the bottle of a champagne bottle?
Yeah, the pont you have at the bottom is there to actually help the strength of the bottle.
But that also helps in placing the wines inside one another in the riddling rack.
Yes, the shape, absolutely. But just to let you know, not that you would like to do that at home, but actually you can take a bottle of champagne, you can walk on it, you will not break it. Don't try it.
I'm going to do it.
And in fact, when I was in Champagne, I used to walk on top of the bottle stacked. We would have like 100,000 bottle stacks, and you could actually walk on it like you would walk on, you know, a pavement. The bottles are very strong.
And then they would yell at you and tell you, get off the bottles, Christian.
So after the 8 weeks of fermentation inside the bottle, we continue to age the wine a couple of years. And the reason for that is very slowly the yeast inside the bottles are going to break down, decompose very slowly, and release wonderful aromatics of vanilla, toasted bread, almonds, and create all the elegance of the champagne. And those reactions that takes place in the bottle are very, very slow, and you, there's really no way to speed them up than simply wait. So after now 2 years, we have a fully carbonated wine, and we need to remove the sediment of dead yeast inside the bottle. Because if you take the bottle and shake it, the bottle becomes very hazy simply because you have those yeast that were used for the fermentation. So we actually place the bottle into a wooden AP-shaped furniture with holes in it, and the bottles are placed upside down in that in those AP's riddling racks, as we call them. And for the next 30 days, we're going to turn the bottle left and right twice a day, and the sediment, very slowly, of yeast will slide down all the way inside the neck of the bottle. After 30 days, we have the bottles are upside down, the sediment is collected into the neck, and the rest of the wine is very clear. Very carefully now, we remove the wines from those riddling racks, and dip each bottle, only the tip of the bottle, about 1.5 inches, into a solution of glycol, very, very cold, about, I would say, minus 24 degrees Fahrenheit. And within 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, we're going to create an ice plug at the tip of the bottle, being upside down. And within, inside the ice plug, is the sediment of yeast we have collected through the riddling. We can now flip the bottle the side up, remove the crown cap with a disgorging tool, and the pressure is going to push the sediment away. We have now a clean wine. We lost about the equivalent of a spoon of champagne, and we replace the lost wine with what we call the dosage, which is old wine and sugar mixed together. It's about a little bit of a teaspoon that we add to the bottle that gives that extra sweetness. If we add more sugar, we can get a demi-sec. If we have less sugar, it's a brut. And following that operation, we place the cork in that little basket to all the corks called the wire hood. And the wine is almost ready to be drunk at that point. You have to wait another 3 months for the dosage, that old wine and sugar, to really marry with the wine and kind of get itself just perfectly assembled with the wine. And then the wine is ready to be drunk. So when you make sparkling wine or champagne, you have 7 or 8 months to make the still wine. Then you have the fermentation in the bottles for another 2 months. Then you get 18 months of aging. You disgorge the wine, finish it, add the dosage. You wait another 3 months. So it's a long process. It takes about 3 years to make champagne, and this is why it's expensive.
Christian, do you know that there are people listening right now that are slapping their forehead going, I get it. You're so good at explaining.
I don't know.
You're fantastic.
If you understand French accent, yes.
Oh,
if you don't, it's going to be difficult.
Just perfect. But, you know, that's maybe the most concise explanation of making champagne that I've ever heard.
Well,
congratulations. You are a superstar.
Thank you, David.
Yes. Hey, thanks very much. Christian Roganaugh, he is the winemaker at Niven Family Wine Estates, and you know, made the wine in Korea for the Seoul Olympics, made wine in Champagne, has made wine for many, many years, sparkling wines and method champenois here in the U.S., and a wealth of knowledge. You're going to be on this show many more times. I need to pick your brain. I guarantee sitting down in any room with you and drinking a wine would be a real pleasure.
Thank you, David.
We'll be back with more Grape Encounters, including wine editor Sarah Schneider from Sunset Magazine, yet another down-to-earth, unpretentious wine expert on Grape Encounters Radio.
Well, David Wilson uncorks the next story. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/Grape Encounters Radio. You are listening to Grape Encounters Radio with David Wilson, broadcasting from our wine cellar studio in idyllic Atascadero, centrally located in the Central Coast wine country of San Luis Obispo County, California.
Back with Grape Encounters Radio, and it is time for Sipping with Sarah. Today we're going to talk about a subject that I think is probably a bit misunderstood by some. It is the subject of corked wine. And when I say that, I have a strong feeling, Sarah, that people are thinking wine with a cork in it as opposed to wine with a screw cap on it.
Exactly. I have people's eyebrows up. What exactly is a corked wine? It has the wrong cork in it?
Yeah, they go, I remember when wines had corks in them.
This is the screw cap people.
There was a reason why the screw caps came along, Sarah.
That's true.
And it has everything to do with corked wine. And you are just a little bit perturbed now.
I am.
I never see you upset, but you kind of came into the session feeling a little miffed.
I'm grumpy.
Why?
Well, this week has been a bad week for wine for me for being corked. It seemed like the problem was getting a little better, and we should probably explain what corked wine is.
All right, have at it.
Okay, here goes the chemistry, I guess. It happens under natural cork because the cork has a substance in it that encourages the growth of a bacteria called trichloroanisole, TCA.
Right.
Doesn't ruin the wine for health reasons or any. It's not going to make you sick, but it makes the wine smell like bottom of the basement stairs. And in this week, for some reason, I've had several bottles of wine that have turned out to be corked. Just yesterday, I was tasting some Rieslings, and one from a winemaker who I really respect, and I had high hopes for this bottle. It was just off, funky, you know, the apple flavors tasted bruised. And I thought, this is weird. Actually, you can have bruised apples, but later I went back to it and gave it another sniff, and there it was. It was corked. It had that musty smell. And if I hadn't known that, I would have just sent that winery packing. That would have been the last of that winery's wines I would have had.
Now, these are wines that you get because you have to try wines from all over the world, poor you. It's your job. And, you know, people are going, oh, poor Sarah.
I keep
you
trying to convince
people. You got a bad bottle
people.
Of wine. That's all we can afford.
But if I had spent my own nickel, and I do buy wine, by the way, but if it had been my own nickel, I would have been even grumpier about
well, yeah.
it.
Yeah. You provide a very important service to people who consume wine because you do get the opportunity to taste them. You've got a great palate, and you can sort out the good from the bad and lead people down the proper path. That's super important. Because there's so much wine out there that we have to have reliable people that we can depend upon to steer us in the right direction. And if one bottle's corked, is there a pretty good chance the rest are going to be as well?
No, bottle-to-bottle thing, and absolutely not.
Why is that?
It happens in that particular cork. Problem has gotten a lot better because they've learned how to clean corks. At first, they were bleaching them, and it turns out the bleach was actually just encouraging the problem more. But they've mended their ways, and so the problem is smaller than it used to be. But it still happens, and to various degrees. Sometimes it's just an enormous smell. Sometimes it's only just barely there. Most people wouldn't notice it. It just sort of depresses the flavor of the fruit.
So the smell is the smell of wet newspapers at the bottom of the basement steps.
That's the closest I can get.
What if somebody's never had a basement? Then what?
A wet dog?
If you open your bottle of wine and it tastes like a wet dog, it might be corked.
And you, if you order one in a restaurant and you get that smell, send it back.
Oh. Makes me wonder, though, with the tremendous influx of wines that now have screw caps.
Sure.
Haven't the cork manufacturers been especially vigilant making sure that the corks they're providing are not TCA contaminated?
They're certainly trying. They can't get it 100% at this point, but they have fixed the problem to a large degree. But even so, you know, what product line would accept 1 or 2 or 3% damages? You know, you make BMWs, it's okay to lose 1 or 2 out of 100. Most products wouldn't accept that level of success. Still, people are so tied to that romance of natural cork, and I love the sound of pop too. Winemakers are sticking with good natural corks.
Do you feel that the lion's majority winemakers that make really premium wines are being ever resistant in terms of going to screw caps?
I think less and less. There were about maybe 15, 20 years ago now, a very premium winery in Napa called Plump Jack bottled its reserve half in screw cap and half under cork.
And how did that sell?
The screw cap sold out instantly.
Why?
It was a novelty to have, you know, $200 wine under screw cap, but they did a lot of studies in the years following with those wines to see how they'd age. And I remember a tasting 10 years out where they got a group of people together and gave them to us blind and said, you figure it out, which is the screw cap, which is the cork. I got it wrong.
Okay, so I see a dilemma here for people listening that they may have just learned enough to be dangerous. We've given them some tools to be able to identify the cork taint, you know, but it's one of those things that not everybody's going to get it. And you're going to be in a restaurant and you are going to get from time to time a wine that has cork taint.
Sure.
And we want you to send it back.
I think it's always...
What do they do? Do they call over somebody who really understands the wine in the restaurant and say, could you please smell this and taste this or whatever? What do you do?
Absolutely. When I find it in a restaurant, I don't challenge this sommelier. Call him or her over and say, I think this is corked. Would you try it? They are so glad if you identify it and don't keep drinking a bottle of wine that's really bad in a restaurant. So they absolutely will take it back, no questions asked.
Okay, so one quickie. You can fix a cork-tainted wine, and there's a way to do it. You're aware of that, right?
I have seen it happen, but it's a shocking thing to do to a wine.
Oh, well, you know what? It's even more shocking to dump it down the kitchen sink.
That's true.
Okay, so you get a bowl, a mixing bowl, and you line the mixing bowl with Saran wrap. And then you pour the wine that is tainted into the bowl, the TCA molecules, for whatever reason, are deeply attracted to the molecules in the Saran wrap. And they go there and they think that they're their parents or something. And they go there and they cling to them for dear life. And you just give it about 10 minutes, let them cling, gently pour it off through a funnel back into the bottle, and you're all better. I've tried it too. It works. So there, it's not hopeless. But, you know, in a restaurant, send it back at home, fix it.
This is not just a wine show. This is Grape Encounters.